This hour, Joe Elder speaks on the cultural and religious history of West Asia. Joe Elder, professor of sociology, languages, and cultures of Asia, has earned a global reputation in international relations. At the UW-Madison, he spent over half a century providing extraordinary teaching, service, and research. Professor Elder trained students to study abroad in India and Nepal, produced numerous documentaries about South Asia, taught classes on Gandhi, and served as a mediator in times of crisis. He was born and raised in India, where his father was a Presbyterian missionary. He spoke on October 25, 2014, at the Capitol Lakes Retirement Center in Madison. His talk is titled, Trying to Understand West Asia, Where We Are and Why We Are Here.
Somebody told me a year ago that what was happening right now would happen. I'd say, you can't be that messy, but it is incredibly messy. Okay, we'll begin with the map. In terms of where I was born, you see something that looks a little bit like a camel's head. That is my representation of where the Kurdish people live. Now, for years, the maps that I would have of this part of the world would have that elephant head and say, Kurds live there, and most people would sort of say, well, who are the Kurds? Well, the Kurds have suddenly become incredibly important in terms of what's happening in that part of the world. Two things about that shape. One is that the Kurds are living in four different countries, and these are countries that have been at war with each other. The Kurds are in Turkey. They cross over into a little bit of Syria, then into Iraq, down almost to Baghdad, then over into Iran. And if you look at the lower right-hand corner of the camel's head, there's a city called Kermanshah. And as far as I'm concerned, the most important thing that happened there was my birth. I was born there, one of six missionary kids. When we were older and smarter, and we recognize how deeply embedded Shiite Islam is and how deeply committed they are to Shiite Islam, and the notion that our parents, who were Presbyterians, had gone to convert the Shiites, we would have said in jest, you really chose a tough country to try to convert people to Christianity. But you were going to increase the population ratio, and you had six kids. And that was your effort to expand the number of Christians in Iran. We never quite said that, but it was sort of implicit. In terms of my own career, I lived in Kermanshah until I was 4 years old, so I remember old family photographs. Then we moved into sort of the heartland of Iran, see a place called Hamadan. And that is historically interesting because in Hamadan, the story of Queen Esther took place. Queen Esther, the Jewish queen, married to the Persian emperor and his uncle Mordecai, and a whole sort of tradition built around that. So I was aware of the Esther stories when I was living in Hamadan. And then the last 7 years of my life, I lived in Tehran, and I was a kid there during World War II. So sort of my perspective of the World War was what happened in Tehran. Okay, let's drop back and look at some of the historical antecedents. And if somebody had said things that happened 3,000 years ago were important, I'd say, look, history moves, but there are memories that are reenacted and reenacted and reinterpreted. And so this territory has a lot of feelings that have to do with the past. We begin with the conquest of Canaan by the children of Israel. And this is really off the map. You'll see this small version there where Israel is, and you see where Lebanon is, the story of Moses crossing from Egypt, the Red Sea, into the Sinai Peninsula, and then under descendants going into Canaan and conquering it and establishing the kingdom of Israel. Zoroaster, I put the dates there because Zoroaster was the founder of the religion that dominated the Persian Empire, and Zoroastrianism is a monotheistic religion, one of those several in the past, that is a strong distinction between light and dark, good and evil. And Zoroastrianism has penetrated into a number of religions, and it was the religion of the Persian Empire, in the notion that there is a light and a dark and a good and a bad, and it's a certain ethic of morality. And one reason Iran feels so unique today is that it does go back to its Zoroastrian history and the great Persian Empire. Ever since the days of Islam, it has been a Muslim country. But for virtually a millennium before that, it was a Zoroastrian country. And this makes Iran distinctive in terms of how it compares itself to the other Arab countries. It is not Arabic. It does not speak Arabic. It has an Indo-European language. And so Iran has an identity which is separate from and therefore different from the rest of the Arab world, and that becomes both interesting and complicated. Babylonian captivity of the Jews, the Empire of Babylon conquered the Jews and brought them to the city of Babylon. You'll see where Babylon is quite close to Baghdad. And that was a period where the Jews were in exile, and some of the most marvelous psalms record the sorrow of the children of Israel who were far from the temple in Jerusalem and who longed to get back to their the Holy Land. And it was the Persians who freed them. The Persians came in and conquered the Babylonians and allowed the children of Israel to go back to Jerusalem. So in terms of the historical context, there are multiple players in the scene, and the Persian Empire was in a way a great source of support for the children of Israel, for those who went back to the temple in Jerusalem and reestablished the land of Israel. The great battle of Marathon was when the Persian Empire clashed with the Greeks. The Greeks won. The Roman conquest of Jerusalem was you had the Romans defeating the Greeks and then taking over the Holy Land. So when Jesus was born in Palestine, it was under the Romans, and the whole story of Herod and so on comes from that particular tradition. And then the Jewish diaspora, the Romans were very angry at the way in which the Jews were responding, and so they destroyed Jerusalem and drove the children of Israel out into the rest of the world. And the Holocaust in the last century was part of the long legacy of oppression and pogroms and so on against the Jews. So that's all background. And when you're talking about people's feelings about what should be done, different groups have different senses of identity and different senses of sort of historical justice. What we did, what we should have recognized, and what we have typically, they all feel they haven't quite benefited from them. Then we get to the right-hand side of the text. Islam comes into this area, and we have the Prophet Muhammad, and you see Mecca. Mecca was a holy city before the Prophet Muhammad was born. There was the so-called Kaaba, the cube that was there, and this was a cube that represented the central place to worship deities of any kind. Jews could worship there, Christians could worship there, polytheists could worship there, ancestor worship could worship, goddess worship could go there. And there was a tribe, the Quraysh tribe, that was doing very well handling the tourist traffic who came to worship at the cube, this sort of building that was square in the center of Mecca. He was born there. He began to have revelations, and he finally became convinced that these were real revelations as God had revealed himself to the prophets going back to Abraham and Isaac all the way through John the Baptist and Jesus. But this was the latest prophecy. And as he preached his prophecy, it was very clearly monotheistic, and it referred to the Jewish Christian heritage. And he was very critical of the idolatry going on in Mecca. And this won him the enmity of the Quraishi tribe, which was making a lot of money off of the tourist pilgrimages. So his life was in danger, as were the lives of his followers. So in 622, he and his followers fled from Mecca up to the north toward Medina. And for the next 10 years, one has the golden era of Islam. Because the story is there, the prophet was regularly receiving messages from God. These are being recorded into what was going to become the Quran. The dwellers in Medina were, on the whole, strong supporters of the prophet. And during that period, there was severe warfare between Medina and Mecca. And it reads very much like the Old Testament story of Jericho and the Canaanites, where when you won, you really committed genocide. Both sides did. It was a horrendous period. And at the end of that 10-year period, with Islam kind of established in Medina, the prophet worked out an arrangement where he could return peacefully back down to Mecca. And for the last 2 years of his life, he lived in Mecca. He cleansed the Kaaba of its idols. And there was a brief period of time when the prophet was alive and Mecca was the center of the Islamic world. When the prophet died, there was a question of who would follow him. And there were a series of caliphs who were imported. And if somebody told me it was important to have a concept of a caliph last month or 2 months ago, I'd say that was a long time ago. But the notion of a caliph goes all the way back to the prophet. And this was to be the successor. The prophet saw himself as three things. He was a prophet. God spoke directly to him. He was a general. He led his armies against the Quraishis and against the enemy armies. And he was a secular ruler. He's a mayor. And he was legislating things like criminal law, marriage law, property law, and so on. And when his death was approaching, he appointed one of his fathers-in-law. And the father-in-law became the first caliph, and he said, I can't be all three. I am just an ordinary person. God doesn't speak directly to me. So I'm not the prophet, but I am the general and the mayor. And so he had a series of caliphs who succeeded as the spokespersons for this Muslim community. The third caliph was Uthman. He's important in a number of ways. He was very concerned that the Quran was disappearing. The Quran had been dictated to the prophet at different moments, at different times, and people would write down what the prophet said God said to him. And they'd write this down on cloth, on paper, on bones, whatever it was. And as the years passed, the question came, where were all these verses? And Uthman decided it was crucial to preserve the verses and get one official issue of the Quran. So the Uthman recension of the Quran became the Quran which is used today. And that is seen by Muslims as the literal word of God. This is what God said to the prophet. And it was written down as exactly as could be done. And the scholars of the period were extremely careful to try to make sure they had the right accent mark. Because Arabic is difficult to the extent that it doesn't have vowels. And so you have a series of consonants. Let's say it's B, L, D, Z, R. And that could be a number of things. It also could be bulldozer. It all depends on what the vowels are between them. So to the extent scholars question the literalness of the Quran, it has to do with which vowel was between which consonant. But other than that, the enormous amount of scholarship that's been conducted about the Quran is truly massive. It's every bit as rich and intense as the rabbinical tradition that follows the Torah and the Talmud, what was meant by this passage and so on. The complications began to merge with the fourth caliph. He was Ali. Ali was the nephew of the prophet and the son-in-law of the prophet. And so Ali said, okay, the caliphs who preceded me were not prophets, but they were generals and they were mayors. But I'm the nephew of the prophet. And so to the extent somebody has kind of authority to interpret what God said to the prophet, I have a little more because I'm of the prophet's kinship group. And that became a source of great tension because there's God's word, there's the Quran, and here's Ali saying, and when there's a question of interpretation, it's not scholars who do it, it's so much as those of us who are directly related to the prophet. So when it came time for Ali to select the caliph, he did something which then sort of triggered the dissipation of the Quranic world. He chose his son. And then you began to have the feeling, uh-oh, this is looking much more like a kingship or rulership of some kind than a prophecy where the person who is most closely open to the word of God has the word. So he chose his first son, and Ali said, I am the first imam. I am authorized to interpret the Quran because of my heredity. And then the next, his son was Hassan, and that became the second imam, and he had the authority to interpret. Then there was the next imam, which is another son, Hussein. And you can see the split. You see the scholars saying it should not be inheritance. It should be scholarship and quality of character. And so we have the Shiites splitting off, selecting a series of successors through relationship. Then you have the Sunnis saying that's a serious mistake. We should not go off in that direction. The crisis came in 680, the Common Era, and that was when the third Imam, Hussein, engaged in a direct confrontation with the Sunnis, and he was beheaded, and his head was displayed as a trophy of victory. So one wants to see the mark of the really violent split between the Shiites and the Sunnis. It was 680, and you had, from that point on, the Shiite-Sunni split went on. And later there was the appearance of Sufis, who are mystics, and the Sufis could be either Shiites or Sunnis. These are people who simply said, God isn't something you read about as a scholar, it's not something you fast about, it's something you wait for a message from within you. And so there is the mystical tradition within Islam, And that's the kind that has often been most appealing on, let's say, current campuses in the United States. The notion, and there is a passage in the Quran that says, God is closer to you than than your heart. And if you listen for God's message, you will get it. You don't need to fast. You don't need to go through rituals. You don't need to go through pilgrimages. I want to point out, going back to the third caliph, Uthman, at that point, probably one could say Islam had clearly defined boundaries. The five pillars of Islam were agreed upon. Islam is extremely simple to talk to people when you say, what do Muslims believe? And they're the five pillars. And wherever you are, this is what a Muslim will say. These are the five pillars. The first is the pillar of the belief in one God and the Prophet Muhammad. La illa Allah, Allah, Muhammad Rasulallah. There is only one God. He's Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Implicit in that, there are a series of prophets before the prophet. Jesus was a prophet. John the Baptist was a prophet. Isaiah was a prophet. And Moses was a prophet. And Abraham was a prophet. And then the other four parts of the pillars are things you do. And this brings a kind of cultural bondedness to Muslims. You pray five times a day. And the purpose of the prayer is to seek forgiveness for constant failure. The prayer is not, God, give me a break. God, make me healthy. It's, God, I have failed again. And five times a day, in principle, every Muslim is to stop and say, how have I messed up in the last 3 hours? And God, forgive me for things I could have said, things I didn't say, and so on. So the five times of prayer a day. Then there's the notion of giving a payment back to God for the wealth he has given to you. And this is like a religious debt I owe. If I have property of any kind, God gave it to me. And I'm not entitled to the whole thing. I must give part of it back. And then the most dramatic one is typically the notion of a pilgrimage. The fifth pillar is the pilgrimage to Mecca, which if you can do, you should try to. It's not mandated. It's expensive. But if possible at some point, you should go to Mecca and there, in a sense, stand where the Prophet stood. There in Mecca, in the on the stone beside the Kaaba, are the footprints of Abraham. Abraham visited there and was inspired. His footprints are there. And there by the Kaaba are the graves of Ishmael and his mother, again, going back to the Old Testament story. So you're there in the presence of the founding principles of Islam. And the Hajj in Mecca have a kind of bonding effect, which is very difficult to find parallel to. Catholicism has the Vatican, Jews have Jerusalem, but there's something about the Hajj in Mecca which is extremely powerful. Plus the fact you have your own calendar and your own months of the year. Shiite pilgrimage, and this comes relevant. After the imams began to appear, where they were buried became important for Shiites. Al-Najaf, that's where Imam Ali is buried. And so that's sacred to the Shiites. Karbala, and that's where Hussein is buried. You go past Baghdad up to the north, you come to a place called Samarra, and that's another Shiite pilgrimage place. So all Muslims, Shiites or Sunni, are supposed to go to Mecca at some point, but the Shiites are also supposed to go, if they can, to Samarra and Karbala and Najaf. So you begin to get a sense of the sacred geography here of where people feel this is our holy land. And if it's to be occupied by infidels or people who are hostile, we have a moral responsibility to relieve them and make sure that these are all safe. Samarra is particularly complicated because there are altogether 12 Shiite imams. We have Ali, Hassan, Hussein, and a series on down the number 12. And the 12th imam went into occultism. It's a term that you can't quite translate. He didn't technically die. He disappeared from sight. And there's the notion among many of the 12ers that he is still alive, or his incarnation is still alive. And at some point, he will come back, and it will be at Samarra, and that will be the parallel of the Messiah coming back to Jerusalem. So there's this eschatological notion of in the end of days, there will be the prophet, the imam coming back, and good will be restored and evil will be destroyed. So you have again, this rich heritage in the background. Most of the world of Muslims is Sunnis, but in the small enclosed map, I show where the Shiites are. They are heavily concentrated in Iran. When I grew up, I must confess, I didn't know there were Shiites and Sunnis. I only knew Shiites, and I assumed all Muslims were the same. And I had lots of buddies who were called Ali, and lots of buddies called Hussein and Hassan and Hassan, without realizing if I were in some other Muslim country, I wouldn't hear those names, because those are such Shiite names. In fact, when the bricklayers would be laying bricks and they would be tossing bricks up to the next day, hey, Ali, hey, Ali, hey, Ali, they said as they would lift it up. So I can recall just it was so embedded in the tradition that Shiite Islam was there. But it's pretty much exclusively in the area of Iran and the southeastern part of Iraq, where the holy sites are to the Shiites. And now when you look at the boundaries, there's the border of Iraq, there's a border of Iran is still pretty much where it used to be. But you can see as you look there that the situation in Iraq will be complicated because there in the lower right-hand section of Iraq is the Shiite land and the Shiite pilgrimage sites. And then you get to the north and you get to the west, and those are not Shiites, those are Sunnis. Are there any questions right now as I'm sort of going to wander away from the ancient history to more or less the last several years? Yeah?
I'm just wondering about beheading.
It goes back to the tradition of tribal groups to deal with criminals. You don't have jails. You don't have social security systems. A person does something bad. You could cut off their arm, and they can't do bad again. Do you risk keeping them as a member? They would be likely to ally themselves to others. And then a way of disposing of them is either to cut off their heads or stone them. And if one wants to be embarrassed, go back to Leviticus. And the children of Israel are told to stone people and to cut off the heads and cut off the arms. So it's a heritage of the Abrahamic traditions, which are tribal groups, where you don't put people in prison for rehabilitation or for security. You're going to be moving around, and they either are going to become sensible members of society, or they're going to be damaged so they can't hurt you, or you're going to end their lives. Now, ironically, the greatest number of beheadings goes on in where? Saudi Arabia. It is a standard form of execution. Now, one reason it's sort of awkward is because here is an ally of ours that systematically beheads people for things like adultery. And yet, when we see two Western journalists beheaded, we are very appalled at it. So in the context, the beheaders can say, what are you so alarmed about? Because your friends have been doing it. And furthermore, when you drop a guided missile and kill a household somewhere, what's so great different? It's you blow up a whole series of innocent people, which is even worse than cutting off the head of an offender. So it's in that context that it's sort of defended by people in this area. But most of us are pretty appalled at the notion of a beheading. But it wasn't until, well, a century ago in France, you were beheading people. The guillotine was well exercised. Just on the border of Syria and Turkey. And there are certain children, certain Jews who feel that's the point where Abraham historically. Yeah, well, if you see the story of Abraham, it begins with Uz, which is down around where Kuwait is. And then he was called by God to go into the land of Canaan. He went up and followed the river, then turned around and came back down into Canaan. And there's sort of a notion, and then he landed in the land of Canaan, and this became the land that was promised to him. But there are a whole series of different groups. It's there's no way in which you can say, this is really what happened, but there are people who, trying to read the passages in Genesis that describe it, the notion is he started here, went up, followed the Euphrates River, took the bend, came down by the Mediterranean, and ended up in the land of Canaan. Well, let's walk through the recent stuff, because in the last year, there have been so many switches where my enemy becomes, if you have the same enemy I have, you become my friend, even though I've hated you up until a week ago. It gets very, very complicated. The surprises of the last year, or the last, ever since the 21st century came in. Okay, where are the borders of the lands in West Asia? From 1326 to 1918, these were territories in the Ottoman Empire. At its peak, it was a huge empire. It controlled most of North Africa, virtually all of Egypt, most of what's in the map here. and at times got over to the edge of Persia. It almost never got into Persia completely, but it dominated Turkey, the central part, we're looking at the map, down left into Egypt and all the way across the northern tier of Africa. Most dramatic conquest was a conquest of Constantinople there in Turkey. It renamed it Istanbul, and this was seen as a clear victory of the Muslims over the Christians. The Ottoman Empire managed to get deep into Europe. 1643, when there were pilgrims already in Massachusetts, the Muslim armies were at Vienna. They'd pushed out that far. And so the succeeding centuries, there's a great concern about the Muslim menace in what is now Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania. Eventually, it was driven back, and eventually it sort of got smaller and smaller, until when World War I came along, it included mostly Turkey, the central part, they were looking at the map, and then sort of ended at Egypt. I put in the name of Abd al-Wahhab because among the Muslims have been a long series of struggles for being better Muslims. And by the time Abd al-Wahhab came along, he was a Sunni, and he was concerned that in the Shiite countries, a lot of elaborations were beginning to emerge. The Sufi mystics were there. The Shiites were there. Imams were there. Birthdays were being celebrated. Saints' days were being celebrated. And Abd al-Wahhab said, we are so far from those 10 golden years when the Prophet was in Medina. Let's get rid of minarets. Let's get rid of graves. Let's get rid of the Shiite imams. Let's go back to the very simple, simple faith of the Prophet with his community of followers, the Ummah and the Quran. So within Islam, there's periodically been these moments of let's get rid of the sort of sloppiness that comes when you get festivals and birthdays and so on. And there's been that Wahhabi element, which is internal looking. It's not looking outside, saying, let's go back to the simple days of Islam before we became corrupt and we got money into things and people were doing all sorts of things that were not in accord with Islam. Then came World War I. Those are the dates. And it was clear the Ottoman Empire had sided itself with the Germans. And so the Ottoman Empire was the enemy in World War I. Ironically, on our side were the French, the Italians, and the British. And so that was this part that won the war. And before the war was ended, well before the war was ended, the British and the French were saying, what can we do to redraw the boundaries of this part of the world after the Ottoman Empire has ended? So in the Paris Conference in 1919, at the end of the war, France acquired the territories of Lebanon and Syria, and the British acquired the territories of Iraq and Jordan. And they were given a mandate by the Paris Accords. Their mandate was to train these countries to become nations. And so you had the notion that these are now sort of colonies, but they're to be mandated out of colonial nature. And ironically, the British succeeded. Iraq became a nation before World War II. Syria became a nation after World War II, but there was the effort by the colonial powers to train these areas so they could have become democratic and have constitutions and civil governments. Then came 1947, and the UN General Assembly had a plan to partition the Palestine into two states, and you had the beginning of probably the most awkward, painful part of the history of this section of the world. Israel came into existence, and the question of where its boundaries were and how it was going to live with its neighbors became exceedingly, exceedingly complicated. No sooner was Israel in existence literally than every nation around Israel attacked it, beginning with the Syrians, the Lebanese, the Jordanians, and the Egyptians. So Israel found itself surrounded by countries that had not voted for it to come into existence, that resented the fact that the UN had said, we'll just take territory from Palestine and give it to the Israelis. And so that sense of unfairness has lingered around from the beginning of time. They took our land. They didn't take land from Canada or Brazil or any other part. They took land from us. And so the tensions there have been very real ever since then. A series of wars between Israel and its neighbors. I just picked one, 1967, the Six-Day War. In this war, the Israeli armies were exceedingly successful. They won practically everything they were after. They won the Sinai, which is this big peninsula between Israel and Egypt, the Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. And the UN at that time said, we can't allow that kind of expansion to continue. So they passed Security Resolution 242, and this comes sort of embedded in the last half a century. This is sort of the last place where the Security Council, and this is the five nations, Soviet Union, China, Britain, France, and England, saying we all agree that those territories should be restored to where they were taken from, and there should be two states coexisting, recognizing each other's borders. And so that principle has been re-enunciated and re-enunciated and re-enunciated as all sorts of things have gone on in that period ever since then. The Resolution 242 is sort of the point to which the UN keeps returning. There is a solution. And President Obama several years ago said the solution is there. We said it, two states living as independent nations, recognizing each other's borders. But it's been extremely hard to achieve them for a variety of reasons. Then comes 1979, Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and now you begin to have the Taliban. And the Taliban, the term means student, and one feature of the student nature of that is that they were primarily refugees who had been driven out of Afghanistan and were in schools in Pakistan and other parts of the world. And in that particular area, they identify themselves as students. They study the Quran, and their notion was that they would go back some point to Afghanistan, drive the Soviet Union out as both infidels and invaders. And Afghanistan has hated invaders ever since the days of Alexander the Great. Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires, and it looks like it's going to continue the same way. And along with driving out the invaders was the notion, let's have an ethical state. The Taliban came in with the notion there's too much corruption, there's too much opium, there's too much sort of evil that's come in. Let's have a sort of a clean state. The term for the clean state is, in the Muslim world, is the Sharia. This is a term for law. And it's made up of three components, so there's flexibility. There is not a Sharia. The Sharia consists of an interpretation based on, first, the Quran, second, what's called the Sunnah, and these are the Prophet's actions. The Prophet was a man. Hundreds of people watched him, recorded what he did, how he ate, what color his beard was, whether he shaved, and so these are all in the Sunnah. This is what the Prophet did. We saw it. And so if you're a Muslim, probably you should do pretty much what the Prophet did. And then there's the third part of that, which has to do with the statements of the Prophet. And those become very, very complicated. Now, there are ultimately thousands of statements attributed to the Prophet. These weren't God speaking to him. This Prophet simply making comments. And these were the hadiths. So the Quran, the Sunnah, and the hadith. So when an issue comes up, what should we do in this case? You turn to the local scholar, mullah, or imam as he's usually called, and say, what do we do here? And he refers to the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Hadith, and says, my interpretation of this is under these circumstances, you pay this kind of a fine. Under these circumstances, your debt must be repaid this way. And so you take these three combinations to the local interpreter, and the local interpreter becomes the final statement. So the Sharia law in Chicago is different from the Sharia law in Amman, which is different from the Sharia law in Indonesia. When it's referred to the Sharia law, it could be very, very severe, or it could be much more modified, depending upon how the person who's doing the interpretation carries on. Then in 2001, the attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and the U.S. at that point made the decision to invade Afghanistan. There are probably two, this is Joe Elder speaking, so be very careful, two really, really bad decisions. One was to invade Afghanistan. Looking back, the chances of that achieving much of anything are very dismal. It's been our longest war. We're still trying to get out of it. And any prediction I see is once the U.S. and NATO troops leave, it's going to collapse. There's no serious basis for assuming it's going to be able to undertake any kind of existence on its own. And certainly when the military aid is withdrawn, the finances will collapse. It's depending almost entirely on the money that's coming in to support the Afghan armies. So that's just sort of a note of pessimism. But the decision was made. And ironically, looking back, there were no Afghans in the planes that crashed the Twin Towers or Pentagon. The people in it were Arabs or from other groups. But Afghanistan was selected as a place to invade because if you need to invade a country, you pick a country. And Osama bin Laden was seen as being protected by Afghanistan. So this weird kind of logic that we will attack a country because an ideologue is in it who may have played a part in coming up with a plan was a stretch of sort of logic. And I think it was probably a result of the feeling that we have such a powerful military force that we can do pretty much anything we want. And indeed, the invasion was extremely successful as invasions go. We started bombing in October, and by December, the Taliban had left. Afghanistan was an open country. They don't leave. They reorganize themselves, and they're very strong still in Afghanistan today. So it's been a long, painful war without much to show for it. Then came 2003. This is Joe Elder's opinion. Another very, very bad decision. Invade Iraq. The notion that there were weapons of mass destruction, which eventually turned out not to be the case, and many of us who protested the coming of that war were saying this is a bad choice. I think most people now accept this was a bad decision. There's still some people who maintain it was the right thing to do. But looking back on how much life and money was spent and how little has resulted, that was also a bad choice. And you get into a war in a country, one thing is almost predictable. You're going to be hated very quickly by the people into whose country you come, even if you say you're bringing democracy or freedom. So we've won a lot of hostile people in that area. 2004, why did the Twin Towers get attacked? There were many explanations. These were jealous people. These were terrible people. These were terrorists who enjoyed doing terrible things. Probably the speech that Osama bin Laden made in 2004 through Al Jazeera was the clearest statement I've seen of the ideology in back of this. Why do you select a group of volunteers who know they're going to be killed to get on planes and attack symbols, you know, two skyscrapers and a Pentagon and something we don't know which, to make some kind of a point when you know they're all going to be dead, and all you manage to do is sort of create a political point. In his speech, he said, look at what America has done. And he cites the way in which Americans or American policies have killed civilians who were Muslims and innocent, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Iraqis, and the Afghans. And then he has to say, America must stop killing our women and children. Al-Qaeda will bleed America as it bled the Soviet Union. And there was the appearance of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So a whole new ideology comes in here. This is not the Taliban. The Taliban want to free Afghanistan from foreigners. This now has a notion of punishing, making it painful for the West to continue killing Muslims. And I think that's probably the ideology which begins to be attractive to people even here in the States, who are looking at the way in which the West is killing people, most of whom are Muslims. The West responds saying, look, the Taliban kills far more Muslims than we kill. But in the context of who's our side and who's on the other side, that seems pretty weak. And Osama bin Laden he said, probably the Americans have killed 4 million Muslims in the last decade. And unless they hurt, they're going to keep killing Muslims. So that is sort of the ideology which I think generates so much of the policy which we've seen emerging since then. Then we come to 2011, the Arab Spring. There was a sort of surprising democratic movements in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Qatar. And then there was a pushback. And of those countries, Tunisia appears to be able to still say, we did it. And there have been the second election coming up in Tunisia. Yemen has done it, Bahrain has done something, Qatar has done it, but then there have been the pushbacks both in Egypt and Libya, which have been pretty tragic, and things are sort of back to where they were. And at this point, Syria comes in, because there was the appearance of the Arab Spring in Syria, the emergence of the anti-Assad fighters in Syria to try to get rid of al-Assad. Al-Assad is a Shiite, he's of the Alawite group. The Shiites have many groups among themselves. And although there are only about 10 or 12% of the Syrians who are Alawites, he has appointed most of his key generals and people in his administration as Alawites. So he has a phenomenon of a Shiite minority, very, very powerful, with al-Assad being the one in charge. He was legitimately elected. And so the opposition in Syria largely is Sunni opposition and Sunni opposition to the Alawites. Then come to 2014. The Islamic State declares a caliphate erasing the border between Syria and Iraq, threatening the Shiites and religious minorities and Kurds, and the U.S. launched its air attacks against the Islamic State. You get some sense of where things are about now, but you see the area from Damascus up to essentially Aleppo is probably controlled more or less by the Alawites and Al-Assad. So one could sort of put in, this is the Shiite group, this is this minority group, but it's very powerful. Then you had the beginning of the rebel groups, and they start down from the north, and it's been difficult to follow them. They weren't particularly well-armed. They would fall back into Turkey and then cross back over. Then came Kurdish government, and the key cities there are Sinjar, where there was this mountain where the refugees went to, Mosul, which fell to the Islamic State, Erbil, which is the capital, and Kirkuk, which also fell to the Islamic State. So the Kurds have been pushed back, and to the extent there is vigorous resistance to the Islamic State, it's from the Kurdish area. The Islamic State, when it began to expand, moved, well, sort of came from no space. It was a combination of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. In the Syria, there was a group called the Jabhat al-Nusra, and the leader of the Syrian Sunni group lined up Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who grew up in Samarra, and they decided to take the al-Qaeda of Iraq into this union with this Syrian group to fall the Islamic State. If you look at the sort of ancestry of the Islamic State, it goes, you begin back in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. One of the ironies of going into Iraq was President Bush insisted that Iraq was playing part, was being supported by al-Qaeda. And one of the ironies there was that Osama bin Laden hated Iraq. He thought Saddam Hussein was much too religious. He denounced Saddam Hussein as an anti-Islamic person and urged Muslims to attack the Assad government. After the war began in Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq appeared. So this was now that group cropping up where it had not existed before. One of the problems with this thing is when you begin to push down on a violent group, it may pop up somewhere else. So where there was virtually no presence of this al-Qaeda notion in Iraq before the U.S. invaded, after the U.S. had been there a couple of years, the same ideology emerged, but it was called al-Qaeda in Iraq. And then al-Qaeda in Iraq banded with the group in Syria, and out comes the Islamic State. So a merger of forces that have been propelled, in a sense, by outside forces to this notion of punishing those who do terrible things with Muslims. The world was startled with how quickly the Islamic State spread. For during the entire period the U.S. was in Iraq, from 2003 to 2011, the U.S. was training what we call the Iraqi security forces. When we left in 2011, we said there were 550,000 Iraqi security forces that we had trained, 500,000. When the Islamic State moved in, that army disintegrated. And one of the questions I think we need to look at is, why did it disintegrate? It was armed, it was trained, it had been trained for essentially 5 or 6 years by American trainers. And now the notion in the last several months of why don't we put some trainers in there, when they were in there for 5 years with full control, lots of money, and the army that was generated did not resist the Islamic State. It raises some very, very interesting questions. One of the parallels I think of here is the observation when China fell, and I put quotes around that. The U.S. had been arming Chiang Kai-shek during World War II. And when the Red Army appeared sort of from the hills of Yunnan, the notion was, well, we've trained the Chinese army. Chiang Kai-shek will defend the country. And yet when the Red Army moved in, the Chiang Kai-shek army simply disintegrated. And it's risky to look at parallels historically, but the reason it failed was that the army of the Chinese Nationalist Army had no support from the public. It was not trusted. When the army was attacked by the Red Army, which had a lot of vigor and a lot of enthusiasm for what it was doing, the Red Army simply pushed right through China, and Chiang Kai-shek and his army crossed over into Taiwan. So we have a question, what happened to that investment in 500,000 security forces, and where are they now? How does the Islamic State finance itself? it's done it largely internally. It's not depending so much on outside forces. It was able to capture a lot of military equipment that had been given to the Iraqi security forces. It also controls oil wells, and it also has a system of internal financing in the areas that it controls. And now a few new groups, then I will stop rambling on. The emergence of Khorasan, K-H-O-R-A-S-A-N. I didn't write it in, but you might want to put it in there. This is a group that wasn't even on the radar until about a month ago. And then suddenly it emerged. And this is a group of Muslims who are urging the random killing of anti-Muslims wherever they can be found. So this is sort of an extension from the Taliban, which said, let's rid Afghanistan of foreigners, to Al-Qaeda says, let's punish those who kill Muslims, to this group, which sort of says, this should be taken on the offensive out to other parts of the world. When the first bombing raid was carried out under President Obama's instructions, the one thing that surprised me was that they bombed Aleppo, and I knew that they were attacking Raqqa, which is in the center, because that's where Islamic State is supposed to have its headquarters. But when they said, we also bombed Aleppo, I looked at Aleppo and said, well, that's not really where ISIS is. And then it turned out, that was the first time that I heard that there was something called this Khorasan group, which was this extremely take violence out of the area and apply it to other parts of the world. What has the U.S. done? Well, one of the first things that was done was to try to get the prime minister of Iraq changed. With a fair amount of elbow twisting, Nouri al-Maliki resigned. He'd been elected recently. He was a Shiite, and he was supposed to sort of integrate the three different parts of Iraq, the Shiites in the south, the Sunnis in the upper left, and the Kurds in the upper right. He had been apparently so oriented towards supporting his own Shiites that in the Sunni areas of Iraq, they deeply distrusted him. And that, I think, is partly why the Islamic State has been so successful. The Shiite areas, the Sunni areas of Iraq, simply have very little confidence in Baghdad. And if the Islamic State comes in and they say they're going to be on your side, don't spend a lot of effort or lose a lot of blood trying to stop them from it. New prime minister came in, Haider al-Abadi. He was also from the same group, essentially, as al-Maliki. He himself is a Shiite. He was in the Druze Committee. And the hope was that he would begin to reintegrate the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis together. He's had about 6 weeks to do it. In my Joe Elder guess is there's no way he can possibly do this. That country is so divided right now, and since the Americans left, it's continued to be divided. So an effort to have a new prime minister come in and pull together a country that is obviously splitting apart is hard to take. In the meantime, Al-Qaeda has separated itself from the Islamic State, which seems a little odd because Islamic State is kind of an outgrowth of Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda, and here I think one has to infer probably a power struggle within the voices speaking for Islamic State and the voices for Al-Qaeda. I see this more as an internal dispute and one of strategy. Al-Qaeda maintained Islamic State was too brutal, the beheadings were too public. Islamic State had the notion that if it looked pretty terrible, it might frighten people to surrender. So there's kind of a different logic in what you do here. Okay, what are the other militias in Syria? There is the Army of Islam. They're the Kurds. The group that has appeared to be most effective have been the Peshmerga. This little area here, which is the Kurdish area, has probably quietly undergone more of a change than any other section of this world. Why? Because as the chaos has continued down here in Baghdad between the Shiites here and the Sunnis here, the Kurds have quietly, and I say this with some pride because you realize I'm a Kurd, have quietly managed to establish a semi-autonomous section of Iraq. They can't say it because Iraq would become furious and you might have a war. But they have their parliament, they have their own elections, they have their own militia, they have their own flag. And so for practical purposes in this little area, they have begun to develop something which could in time become a Kurdish country. Now having said that, there's a great deal of anxiety because you have the Kurds, we're talking about the Kurds here in Iraq, but if they have their separate state, why don't the Kurds in Turkey come in, the Kurds in Syria come in, and the Kurds in Iran come in? And that makes everybody very, very anxious. The last point I'm going to make is to look at the city of Kobani, The last week, there's been a great deal of discussion about Kobani. And the reason for that is that the Turks have been extremely reluctant to get involved in this particular conflict. And the U.S. would like the Turks to become involved. The U.S. maintains, Turkey, it's to your interest to have the Islamic State destroyed. Turkey is Sunni, but Turkey is also hostile to the extraordinary amount of violence that the Islamic State has. The U.S. tried to get Turkey to allow it to let the U.S. military use the Incirlik air base, and Turkey has said no. So the U.S. raids that are being carried on are either from the Mediterranean or for the Gulf, and that's a much longer flight for the American planes to take. The last week, pressure has been brought on the Turks to open up the border at Kobani for two things. One, for Kurdish refugees to flow to the north, and the other is for Kurds from Turkey who want to join the Kurds to come in over the border to help their fellow Kurds. And this has presented a dilemma for the Turkish government, because if you get too many Kurds in Turkey with the idea of an independent state, then Turkey has a problem, because Turkey has been very suspicious of the Kurds in Turkey, has slapped them down periodically, and only recently allowed the schools in this part of Turkey even to teach Kurdish. The feeling was that if you teach Kurdish, you're going to generate Turkish nationalism, and that will pull things apart. So Turkey's playing an odd spot here, but the U.S. has brought great pressure on Turkey to open up Kobani so that Kurds can come in to support the Kurds in the area here, and refugees can go to the north. Well, I think that's pretty much all that I plan to spell out. President Obama on September 10th said that his goal was to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. You do that, the plan was, with no U.S. boots on the ground. There have been huge, huge debates as to, is it even possible to do this? The president has pretty much continued with the no boots on the ground notion, but if one looks at the talk shows, there's constant pressure from the right to begin getting troops on the ground, if only to guide where the air attacks are carried out. There has also been a recommendation that the U.S. impose a no-fly zone over sections of Syria, and the U.S. has been reluctant to do that, because if you have a no-fly zone and you try to enforce it, it's likely a U.S. plane to be shot down, and then you're back into a war. So we're at a pretty touchy point right now. Knowing how complicated it is doesn't make it any simpler. Looking at mistakes that we feel we made may say it pays to read history a little bit carefully so that we don't repeat the worst of the mistakes that we've had.
You've just listened to Professor Emeritus Joe Elder speaking on the cultural and religious history of West Asia. He spoke on October 25, 2014, at the Capitol Lakes Retirement Center in Madison. For more thought-provoking programs by the Madison Institute, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org. And you are listening to WMUU 102.9 FM. We are broadcasting from 122 State Street, home of the Fountain in downtown Madison. WMUU, radio that moves you.